Member-supported Jazz 90.1 proudly welcomes you to America's longest-running computer show, Soundbites. Call the show now at 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll-free 800-790-0415 or soundbites.org. Now, alongside Steve Ray and Dave Enright, here's Nick Francesco on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Good afternoon, Mr. and Mrs. America, and all the chips in the PC. It is Saturday, the very last Saturday of Year of Our Lord 2012, and you lucky people, you're listening to Soundbites. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Linda Wildman, filling in for Dave Enright.
And we'll be bringing you news, views, things to choose, nothing to lose. Kick off your shoes. Don't get the blues. It's going to be a long couple hours if it's just you and me, Linda.
I think so.
Dave, we already knew, was one step ahead of the law somewhere in the Midwest, but I did not know that Steve was going to be with him. So we'll start with the news, and you can give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299, toll-free, 1-800-790-0415. Don't just call with computer questions. I'd like to know what Santa brought you in the way of tech stuff and how much fun you're having with it. But we'll start with the news. Shoppers said they were going to be more cautious with their holiday spending this season, but that didn't stop millions of people from putting iPhones, iPads, Android tablets, Android phones, and other smart devices under the Christmas tree. A record number of smart devices were activated on December 25th. A whopping 17.5 million. That's a 332% increase over the average per day. This beats last year's record-breaking number, which was 6.8 million, again, single-day activations. Though smartphones usually outdo tablet activations on Christmas, it was pretty much an even split, with tablets squeaking ahead with 51%. Many of those tablets were iPads, but Kindles did very well with their Kindle Fire line. Christmas 2012 was also a record-breaking day for app downloads, 328 million on December 25th, as compared to an average of 155 a day. That's an 87% increase in apps, and that's just from iTunes. This isn't as big a jump as last year when app downloads tripled, but it's a nice bump, and I'm sure Apple isn't complaining. The top five apps that people downloaded on Christmas Day, and this is, again, just for Apple. YouTube was number one. Google Maps was number two. We'll have more about that later. Elf Yourself, I don't even know what that is, nor do I want to know. I believe it's a picture where you turn yourself into an elf, an app where you turn a picture of yourself into an elf. Where's My Holiday from Disney, along with all the Where's My... Hey! And Skype for iPad. App downloads are pretty consistent throughout the day, peaking about 10 a.m., but remaining solid through about 10 p.m. Amazon's digital media selection grew to over 23 million movies, TV shows, songs, magazines, books, audiobooks, popular apps, and games. Prime Instant Video selections increased from 12,000 to over 33,000. Amazon Instant Video selections increased from 100,000 to 145,000 movie and TV episodes. Amazon's App Store for Android selection nearly tripled in 2012. Sales of apps and games during the holiday period alone were up more than 250% just for Amazon. All in all, it was a very smart Christmas for Apple, Amazon, Android, and several other smart device manufacturers. So our question to you at soundbites.org, that's bites with a Y, Francis would like us to remind you, did you get an e-device for Christmas? The choices are yes, no, and I'm okay with it, no, and I hate my parents, spouse, other whatever, and I bought my own. Which does not seem to be active, which is interesting. What happened there? Well, that is interesting. I will have to fix that. Probably can't fix it during the show. Huh. I'll fix that, though, later on this afternoon. But at any rate, you can still put stuff into the poll if you know how to get to it. And that's at my website, asknick.com.
That's AskNick. com.
And the question there is, did you get an e-device for Christmas? And how do you like it? And, of course, that's our question to you. So give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free, 1-800-790-0415. And welcome to Mr. Steve Ray.
Greetings.
The late Steve Ray.
Well, since I was so early last week.
Yeah, right.
And the roads were worse this week than they were expected to be last week.
Yeah, right, exactly. Steve was very early last week, and it was because he expected the roads to be horrible. This week, they said the roads were fine. They were wrong.
They were wrong, yeah, completely wrong.
Yeah, I drove my my daughter to work at 7 o'clock this morning, and the roads were, as they say, greasy. Greasy. let's just put it that way. And at least this time, I will say this. 7 o'clock in the morning, the roads were greasy, but there weren't idiots out on the road. There was nobody out on the road.
Yeah.
This time, the roads were still greasy, but I actually saw only one idiot. You know, I don't know what it is about driving in the snow in Rochester, but otherwise sane, intelligent, normal human beings become raving, drooling, maniacal morons when they get out in their cars in the snow. It makes me insaner.
What I always think is it's they've got four-wheel drive. So they're thinking, oh, I've got four-wheel drive. Well, yeah, that's four-wheel go. That's not four-wheel stop.
Right, right. Physics always wins. And physics always wins over you thinking you've got four-wheel drive.
Inertia is mass times velocity.
Something along that lines, yes. You were actually awake during math class.
Yeah.
Wow.
I watch Rocket City Rednecks.
There you go. Is that still on?
New season starting.
No way!
Yeah, they did remote control full-scale vehicles. They launched their own rocket. There's apparently NASA. Rocket City Rednecks is a show on History Channel, one of the History Channels.
One of the channels that doesn't have anything to do with its name anymore, yeah.
And it's about a bunch of guys in Huntsville, Alabama. Who do rockets on the weekends?
Yep.
And they are rocket scientists. The one daddy is a former Apollo engineer for the space program, and Travis and Pete have like 27 doctorates between them. I also found out that Travis is a science fiction writer. He's got a dozen books out, and so they do these cool rocket things on the weekend. Apparently, a space camp in Huntsville, they have an annual big rocket show, So Travis and the boys put together a 30-foot rocket and tried to go launch it. They wouldn't let him.
Yeah, that.
So they went over to the airport and launched it.
There you go.
The launch was beautiful. The parachute didn't come out enough. And
see, there's two parts to
launch
any rocket.
And recovery.
Almost everybody gets part one right.
Yeah, it's not a successful flight until you've had a successful recovery.
That's exactly right. Although, when part one goes wrong.
Yeah.
As long as you're only viewing it from a very great distance, it's spectacular.
Yep. They were supposed to have their astronaut, so they had a mannequin in the nose cone. So that's how big the rocket was. They had a full-size mannequin in the nose cone, and they had an ejection charge because they were trying to figure out how do you eject the capsule to get the parachutes back and how that's going to need a huge parachute. So then they called up one of their buddies. Well, why don't you just do what Yuri Gagarin did? When he was done with his flight, he just walked out the door and landed with a regular parachute.
Yeah.
So they had an ejection charge to eject the mannequin out the door, and so he could land with a regular parachute. They apparently had a little too much black powder. In some of their testing, they burned up some parachutes. That's why this Rocket City Rednecks.
Yeah, exactly. I neglected to acknowledge the fact that Linda has graciously stepped in to take Dave's place today on the board. We appreciate that very much, since I don't know thing one or thing two about the board. And I'm very happy that way, by the way. Just so you understand how that works here, I am very happy to not be on the board.
Don't feel the need to increase your skill set?
No.
That's actually one of my pet peeves that we hear all the time in our store, because, you know, we do Mac repairs and Mac support, is you can't hook a Mac onto PC network, or you can't share files between Macs and PCs. Well, of course you can.
Yes, of course you can.
And there's a big thing in the PC IT world about getting letters after your name, getting all these certifications. Well, take an Apple course. Get an Apple certification, too.
Yeah, right. So you would maybe know you can put an Apple computer on a network along with... The network doesn't care.
Yeah.
Unless you're using... what was the early Windows networking?
NetBIOS?
NetBIOS.
IPX.
IPX.
The IPX protocols, we used to have them, but they're old and deprecated now.
Right,
but yeah.
Right. But the network doesn't care. Almost every network on Earth these days is just TCP IP.
So the networks were built for Unix, so the fact that Windows works on them is
exactly,
a hack.
Exactly. We Unix and Linux people think all of y'all are newcomers and shouldn't even be on our networks. Get the hell off of them now. But seriously, that's the kind of thing that makes me crazy, too. Well, I'd love to put it on the network, but I have a Mac. Okay. Did you pour concrete in the...
The Ethernet jack that's built
port?
In.
Yeah. That, I don't know why you can't put it on the network. Literally, plug it in. It will be on the network.
Yep.
It's that difficult. If you can figure out how to plug the Ethernet jack in, you're on the network. If you're doing wireless, it's a little harder. You have to start the wireless.
And maybe type in a password.
So it's much, much harder. But networking is networking is networking and has absolutely nothing to do with the operating system. I don't know of an operating system these days. I'm sure there's some obscure one that the folks in the IRC chat will come up with. But I don't know of a used common operating system these days that doesn't have networking built in. And by networking, I mean we can get on an Ethernet network and everybody else who's on the network is on the network too.
The $40 Raspberry Pi has an Ethernet built in. In fact, I saw the coolest hack. The guy wanted to do wireless speakers, which you can buy for like $200. But he had a nice big stereo system. So Apple has a solution, the Airport Express, that you plug your stereo into your network. That's $100. Well, I can do better than that. So he bought a Raspberry Pi. He bought a USB Wi-Fi. And he wrote little code and turned it into a wireless streaming music thing for, you know, $40 in parts.
Yeah, exactly. and a half an hour programming.
Yep.
Exactly.
And then wires dangling everywhere, but that's cool.
Now, why do you do that? Because the instant you said Raspberry Pi, my head went for what you can eat.
I saw an interview.
Hold on a second. The Raspberry Pi is a little device. And it's Pi, like 3.14159. It's Raspberry Pi.
As in the mathematical Pi.
And it's a little tiny device, looks like a slightly large stick of gum. And it's $40, or $25, depends on which version you buy.
Yeah, without Ethernet, it's like $25.
So it actually doesn't... $40.
It's a full computer on a little tiny pack of
$40
pack of
computer.
So it doesn't look anything like Pi.
No, it looks nothing like Pi.
But the logo is a Raspberry Buckyball.
Yeah, it is.
Because I was watching an interview on This Week in Tech. They were interviewing the guys that created Raspberry Pi. And we're talking about that. Yeah, it's a Buckyball. You can see like 12 of the vertices of the Buckyball.
Yeah.
we sometimes call it a soccer
and
ball.
And it's designed to be a little play-with-it computer. You know, for $40, you get a full-blown Linux computer. You can put an operating system on it. You can put, it's got wireless if you buy that version. It's got USB. You can hook up keyboard, mouse. You can add on stuff so that you could get a video card. You could turn it into a full-blown computer. Most people use them as secondary devices. I know a guy who's added a terabyte hard drive to one, and now it's just network storage. It sits on his network. You know, it was the cost of the drive plus about $40.
Yep.
And it sits on the network, and that's where he does all his storage.
Yeah, they had an interesting history of it. Cambridge University, I think it was, in England, they had noticed a drop in applications for the computer science programs. And people weren't tinkering with computers anymore. That they didn't know how to use them, but they didn't know how to program or didn't know how to make things. And so it's part of the big maker culture that's happened in the last few years. So they built this thing to be able to release to people to play with, and noticed their applications for enrollment, you know, skyrocketed after people, you know, play. It's cheap enough that anyone can get one and play with it.
Well, this is the thing that makes me sad about both Windows and the Mac. There's no basic for them anymore.
Built in. You can get it,
but they were free.
Yeah.
And much as everybody vilifies BASIC, oh, it's not a real programming language, I don't really care. The reality is that an entire generation of people learned to enjoy programming because they had access to a free version of BASIC.
Yep.
And all of them moved on to real programming languages, you snobs.
Yeah, the Mac
but
comes.
But the fact is, they started with a version of BASIC that was just available to them for free.
Yep. Right now, they come with PHP and JavaScript what else? Ruby and lots of languages, but not BASIC anymore. You need something to really, you know, 10.
To start with.
10, print, hello, 20, go to 10.
It was easy enough that everybody could play with it. We're going to take a quick break, back in just a couple of minutes, with Linda Wildman, Steve Ray, me, Nick Francesco, and you. It's 19 minutes after the hour. We're Soundbites on member-supported Jazz 90.1. Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Steve Ray.
Linda Wildman filling in for Dave Enright.
And at 22 minutes after the hour, we are Soundbites. I figured out what I did wrong with the poll. I'll fix it later. I know what I did wrong. This is an interesting news article. And don't forget, you can give us a call. Join in the fun, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free, 1-800-790-0415. Some of the best basic iPhone apps hitting the iOS App Store lately aren't from the iPhone maker, but from one of its biggest rivals, Google, who recently relaunched a series of well-received apps for Apple's flagship devices, is now courting Apple developers in addition to wooing Apple users over to Android. This week, the company published a recruiting video for an in-house iOS developer team. This video is just the latest part of a recent push from Google emphasizing its commitment to Apple's platform after its Google Maps and YouTube apps were dumped from their default presence in iOS devices this summer. Google acted shocked, and semi-insecure, publicly at least, when Apple made it known that both apps would no longer come pre-installed on its devices. Away from the public war of words, Google has not only recovered from the fallout, but has come roaring back and embraced its status as just another developer working on Apple's platform and one that's trying to best Apple at its own game. You can see this outward confidence in the new video, which invites iOS developers to come do cool things that matter. Google isn't just making cool apps that people like on a competing platform, such as its Android mobile OS. It's making well-liked apps that are core to the functionality of its rivals' devices. By improving on Apple's Mail, Maps, Safari, Camera, and Siri with apps of its own, Google is successfully beginning to wedge itself between the iPhone and iPad maker and its customers. And in the process, it's begun to build its own lot of loyal iPhone and iPad users. And it's not an accident. The company's iOS development team has cultivated a specific look and feel for its products on Apple's platform. Now it's devoted and building whole teams to create apps for iOS. After years of internal debate over the role of apps or websites as the best home for Google devices, for Google services on mobile devices, it's become pretty clear that those within Google advocating for better apps have prevailed. Translation, Google doesn't care where you use their apps as long as you do use Google's apps. People are starting to take notice of Google's improvement at the same time that Apple's design shops have begun taking some heat. When Apple releases a new app these days, its design is nitpicked to death, and complaints about gaudy textures, poor functionality, and confused design details get the design community and users in a huff, sometimes in a minute and a half. The Apple Maps disaster is just one example, but podcasts, Siri, Calendar, Game Center, and more have also been met with criticism. 2013 is going to be a year when Apple must prove itself again in many ways. Can its leaders improve the company in the eye of investors? Can it come up with more revolutionary products that keep customers coming back? And that's revolutionary, not evolutionary. Can it continue to stave off tablet challengers? But our question to you, have you tried the Google Apps for iOS? Give us a call. 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 1-800-790-0415.
A lot of people have been quick to point out in the blogs that Google makes a lot more apps for Apple's platform than Apple makes for Google's platform.
Yes. And I think that's a bad thing for Apple.
Yeah.
I really do.
It goes back to what you said. Google doesn't care what platform you use their apps on as long as you use their apps.
They're completely agnostic about that. Do they make a platform? Yes. Are they absolutely insistent you only use it? No.
Amazon is the same way. They make their Kindle app and their shopping apps available for all the platforms, including their own.
That's exactly right. It's Apple who believes in, seems to believe in that wall between them and the rest of the world, and I don't know why. I don't know that. I don't know that that's in any way good for them in the long run. You know? I'm sorry, I just don't know that it is. But I guess that's their choice. They've got a lot more money than I have, so I suppose they ought to know what they're doing one way or the other. But yeah, I'll tell you, I really have found I can't honestly live without Google directions, Google navigation. I have no sense of direction. I never have had. I lived in Rochester a good portion of my life. I can't tell you up from down. But I can just throw an address at my navigator and off we go. And I always get there. It never screws me. It screwed me up once. Just once. And I relayed this before. A friend of mine lives just past the end of the road in the southern tier down below the Finger Lakes. Literally, the pavement ends. There's dirt road. There's a rod and gun club. There's more dirt road. There's his driveway. And there's an avalanche that has closed off the rest of the road. And the first time I actually used Google Maps to go there, it took us around to the other end of the road, which, yes, is closer to his house, but there's an avalanche at that end.
Well, then you drive up and over, right?
And not in my car. Yeah, maybe if I had one of those four-wheel wonder jobs that they have in the commercials, I could do that, but not in the car that I had. So I actually, there's a little thing that says destination is not here. So I clicked the button on the app and I got to put in and said, what's the problem? I said, there's an avalanche at this end of the road. We can't
get
there.
What did the nice lady say?
No. I got a thing back about a week later that said, thank you for your feedback. We'll look into it. About a week after that, I got an email back saying, you're correct. Thank you for telling me I know what an avalanche looks like.
The DOT could have cleaned it up before they investigated it.
Yeah, the DOT is never going to clean this up. And I guess what I said. I said, there's an avalanche at this end. They are never going to clean it up because there's nothing here. So it's permanently blocked off. It's been here for like 40 years.
Think if it were 40 years, it'd be on some map.
You would certainly think so. But, you know, the road goes from here to there. Is there a landslide in the middle? Yeah, we don't care. The road goes from here to there. And then about a week after that, I got a thing back saying, yeah, we fixed it. Thanks. And so the next time I went, I flicked it on. It took me around the other way. Cool. I was very, very impressed, actually. Yeah, it's not actually an avalanche. It's a landslide. You're absolutely right. But avalanche is a funnier word. So it was pretty interesting. I mean, honestly, the road is gone. There's man-high rocks and dirt covering the road there in a slant going from lower left to upper right to the hill there. And it clearly was a landslide, a rock slide, whatever you want to call it, that took out that whole section of the road. Luckily, it was past his driveway, I guess. And that was long enough ago that it was not a big deal.
And hopefully past his home.
There's trees growing up on it, for Pete's sake. You'd think somebody would have noticed it beforehand, but okay, that's fine, whatever. And they fixed it, you know, so that was kind of nice. And that's the kind of service that you don't normally expect from a free application. But Google has a dedication to making sure that its apps are 100% accurate. That's what they pride themselves on. And so they're working on that. We've seen the Apple van, the camera truck.
The Google van.
The Google van driving around.
That was a slip.
Did I say Apple?
Yeah.
Yeah.
What's even neat, too, they have a little car driving around. They have a guy on a bicycle.
Yes.
A three-wheel bicycle driving, you know, riding in plazas and whatnot.
The RIT campus.
We were looking at the RIT campus, and there was a shot where we could see his reflection in the glass wall.
Yep.
And it was really neat. His little tricycle and his antenna sticking out of the back.
And cameras everywhere, pointing all over the place. Yep. It was very, very cool. And so Google sends that thing around, and so that's why their apps are... at least their navigation app is as accurate as it is, and it's a nice thing to see. But you know what? I want to get back to programming. You're right. You can program in PHP, which is also not a real programming language, blah, 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 and things like that. But you can't really program in BASIC anymore because you have to go out and actually get it. You have to go out and often purchase it. Or at the very least install it. Even on Linux, you have to install it. And what you end up with is people don't know programming like they used to. They don't play with it like they used to. Even something like HyperCard, what a brilliant piece of hard software that was.
Just celebrated its 25th anniversary.
Yeah, 25th anniversary, 23 of those years not on... The Apple operating system anymore, and nobody's really recreated it for Windows or Linux. They do have RunRev has a product called LiveCode, which is essentially HyperCard for developing apps. So you can create apps for Android or for Apple, and I believe for BlackBerry and Windows 8 and a bunch of other things. Also for desktops and laptops and stuff, multiple operating systems. But you have to know to go out and get it, and it costs you $1,000. You know, the free, just here it is, it's on your machine. Here's a way to program. Here's some cool programs. There used to be a whole industry of people writing quick BASIC, not necessarily quick BASIC, but quick, BASIC code programs for people to type in or download and play with and run, and lots of little games and little utilities and ways to learn how to program on your machines. And people just don't do that anymore. The industry doesn't exist anymore, and people don't learn to program anymore. You say to people what languages you program in, and they look at you like you're crazy. Unless they're actually taking a language like Java, they don't know how to program.
Yep. And in the early days, that's all there was. You bought a computer, and then you wrote your own programs to do what you wanted with it.
Right.
And
one of the reasons you bought it is because you wanted to play around with programming. Yeah. Most people don't even do that anymore. They buy it now so they can do Facebook.
Yeah. I did find Chipmunk BASIC that looks like it's a free version of BASIC for Mac, Windows, and Linux. Works on Mac Mountain Lion. They don't say for Windows, it just says XP. I don't know. It works under Windows 7, but we'll see if it works under Windows 8 eventually, too. So it's this guy who wrote a BASIC interpreter. That was always my big question, is what language do you write a language in?
If it's fourth, you write it in fourth.
Yeah, because you need a language ahead of time, yeah. So, yeah, there are BASICs you can get. There's some commercial BASICs. Was it Real BASIC is one of the big ones? Visual Studio, Visual Basic Studio, something like that.
You can buy a lot of them, but you used to get them free with the operating system. So Linux comes with several, actually. But even so, you have to install them. They don't come installed, and there's no longer a world built around them.
Yeah.
You know, an industry built around them. And if you were to just type in, search for BASIC, you come up with any program that has the word BASIC in it.
Yeah. That was a little tricky finding an actual BASIC. See, it's a BASIC interpreter, so you have to know the words.
Right, right, right. Bywater Basic is built in. Free Basic, Mono Visual Basic is actually in Linux, and like that. So
Objective Basic, isn't that an oxymoron?
Well, but that's the thing. Basic has become more than just that 10 go to 20, 20 go to 10, whatever it is. There's a program for you.
Yeah.
Want to stress test your hardware?
Your printer. Yeah, we knew there was a problem when the guy handed us the huge sheaf of paper. Oh, it had an infinite loop. Because they made sure that the printer stopped at 10,000 lines.
Yeah, right. There's SDL Basic, which is for game development, which is very cool. YA Basic, yet another basic interpreter.
Yep.
So there's a bunch of them that are out there. There's amazing stuff out there.
And I think, I've always thought that helped, because when I was in school, all there was programming. So, you know, I learned 6 or 7 languages. And I've always thought that that's helped me in troubleshooting and repair. I kind of know how computers are supposed to work. And so when they don't, you follow that logical progression. And right. Sometimes I even, you know, see in my head, well, okay, the programmer missed a comma or something. No.
Right. Well, and, you know, it used to be, you're right, it used to be when you wanted a program to do something, you wrote it. Now you look for an app.
Yeah. Someone else probably already has. And if you wait a day, they will.
Yeah, right. And I grant you that app writing is not as easy as writing simple command line basic programs was back in the day. I do get that. I actually get that. But even so, it should be fairly easy. And there are easy things. There's a program, and it's from Google, and I can't think of the name of it, that lets you essentially put building blocks together like they were a jigsaw puzzle to write simple apps. And that's kind of fun. And a bunch of other stuff that's out there. But I don't see us encouraging...
Simple. That's the name of it.
Oh, is it?
Yes. code.google.com/simple, I think. Programming made simple.
Is that the one? No, I don't think so. Maybe they've changed the name. It used to be called something else if it was. But we don't see people encouraging that sort of thing anymore. We see them encouraging, go out and buy an app. You know, here's a game you can play. But not to me, it was always the actual programming was the game. The playing with the machine itself was the game. But they just don't really do that.
Yep.
All right, listen, we're going to take another break. I think I've been complaining enough, so you need to give us a call. The number is 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free, 1-800-790-0415. Back in just a couple of minutes with Linda Weilman, Steve Ray, me, Nick Francesco, and you. It's 39 minutes after the hour. We are Soundbites right here on the Truly Great Member supported Jazz 90.1. Hey everybody, I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Steve Ray.
I'm Linda Weilman.
At 42 minutes after the hour, we are Soundbites, and the poll is up. So is the Ustream. So we're all good to go, and it's all happening. It's very exciting. And back to the news.
Well, before we go back, we were talking about programming and we're getting into the whole Make culture now. Make magazine is available for people who like to build little projects, you know, hardware hacking, software hacking, and 3D printing. 3D printers have radically dropped in price. You can get a decent 3D printer for under $500 now to make little 3D things yourself. And there's places here in Rochester. There's Interlock Rochester that is a hacker space where you can go and learn how to program and basically hack. And then there's the Rochester Maker Space for kids to go and make things. They both have 3D printers available. And then App Rochester for application development, if you're specifically looking to develop an app for one of the mobile platforms. But just, you know, getting into hacking and making things. And we're talking over the break that I fly model rockets with with my son and getting him into building the rockets and learning about rockets and aerodynamics and trajectory. There's a lot of science behind there, just pushing the button and watching something fly through the air. So it's we're seeing a resurgence in making things and building things from over the years.
Yep, yep. All right, we're going to go to the phones now. Our first caller is JJ, who's calling from Oakfield. Where, Oakfield where?
Just outside of Batavia, just north of Batavia's Oakfield.
Oh, there you go. Thanks. What's up?
Well, way back, I used to do DOS, speaking of programming. But anyway, I have a question about backing up my computers. I have a desktop that I have that Carbonite. They back it up for me all the time.
Yep.
But my kids come home with their laptops, and I'm worried. I don't want to spend for Carbonite for both their laptops. I'm wondering, is there a way to send their files to my desktop?
Yes. Sure. You can, if you're all on the same network.
Yes.
And you can see their computers and they can see your computers. You can open up a folder for sharing. They can then copy all of their files into that. It's manual, right? Because there's no automatic now.
Okay.
They can copy all of their files into that folder, and then when Carbonite, if it's in the path that Carbonite backs up, Carbonite will back those up too.
I can set that path. I know that how to do that. But actually, speaking of DOS, would there be like a way I could write that in DOS just to do a batch backup of some sort?
Well, you can. The problem becomes. You said they were home from school?
Well, they come home at night, and I just want to make sure they're backed up. You know, the laptops are backed up.
Oh, so they're there every evening?
Yes.
Oh, well, then you can do it the other way. You can open up. Well, I don't know if Carbonite will do that.
Well, the tricky thing is knowing what folder of theirs you want copied to your machine and finding out which of the new files. That's where something like a backup program would work. Or you could use a synchronization program, something like SugarSync will synchronize files between computers. So you can set a folder on their machine to sync to a folder on your machine. Or you could, if they don't have much data, you could use some of the free cloud syncing services. Google Drive gives you 5 gigabytes. Microsoft SkyDrive gives you 7 gigabytes. Dropbox gives you 2 gigabytes for free. And then it synchronizes your data to the cloud. Which is similar to Carbonite, but it's very limited in how much. Carbonite's nice because it will back up everything on your computer as a commercial pay service. So you can manually copy stuff from their computer to yours, and then Carbonite will back it up. Or you could use a syncing program to synchronize a folder on their machine to your machine.
Great. Yeah, I think I'll do a combination of both.
With XCopy, if you know the path. Now, here I go. I'm thinking in my head. I'm typing the command. X copy, N colon backup folder, C colon backup folder.
Right. Yes, you can do it with something like X copy. Something like SugarSync makes it automatic. So you can say, let's say you know their computers are on at 9 o'clock every night. And so is yours. You can set it up to say at 9 o'clock every night, take everything from this folder on the kid's machine and move it to that folder on dad's machine.
Perfect.
And that'll happen in the background, and then Carbonite kicks off, say, at 2 a.m., and it'll back up whatever's in that folder.
Is there an rsync for DOS?
There's not rsync as such.
Yeah, same concept.
Yeah, same concept. But yeah, I would that's the way I would do it.
That's the way you do it, isn't it?
No, see, because I'm using Linux, there is a program called rsync, which backs up only the changed pieces of files. So it's very fast. So I create a new file, it sends the whole file up. But if I just, and I have a server of my own out on the internet, so I just back it up to that.
You have your own private cloud.
Exactly. So what I do is I've got a... my wife has shared one of her documents folder, so I rsync that to my machine at 1 a.m. and then rsync my machine at 2 a.m.
Okay. Yep.
So that way I get everything, but it's the same basic idea as what you're talking about doing. Only I've automated it all through Linux. You would need to use a program like SugarSync on the PC to do that.
All right, I'll look into that. Thanks, guys.
There you go.
Awesome.
Yep. And now remember, that's a synchronization program. If you delete a file on one machine, it deletes it from the other machine too. So it's backup and sync are different functions. But sometimes you want to do a synchronization. So when I delete this file, it does get deleted from the other end.
Right. Oh, and yes, Archandra's right. You can install Cygwin. I don't wish that on anyone.
Yeah, I'm seeing that there are a few rsync-type programs for Windows. It's built into the Mac because the Mac is Unix.
Right, but mostly you need something like Cygwin running. The other thing you can do, of course, is there used to be a program called RoboCopy, which I haven't found, but RoboCopy would do the same stuff. All right, back to the phones. Our next caller is Trish, calling from Clifton Springs, New York. Welcome, Trish. How are you?
I'm fine, and how are you guys today?
Peachy, thanks. What can we do to make you a happier person?
Right now, my husband has somehow managed to move his monitor screen view to the right of the monitor, and I can't remember how to get it to calibrate to the screen.
Yeah, there's usually buttons on the monitor that bring up...
Well, it's a laptop.
Okay, then when you say to the right, you mean there's another monitor over there and you want it back on the main one?
No. What I mean is the actual screen of the laptop seems to have migrated to the right so that there's a black spot with a line on the left and the view is skewed to the right.
It thinks there's another monitor to the right and the image has been moved slightly over, I think.
Yeah, that may be what happens. Every laptop is a little bit different, but often you will see on the keyboard, and it's often F3, there's a little sometimes blue or green or yellow, a mark above or underneath the F3 printing that shows you both a laptop and a screen.
Sometimes it's two little screens.
Sometimes it's two little screens. If you hit function and that key, it will cycle between the laptop screen, the external screen, which you obviously don't have one of at the moment, or both.
Okay, and here it looks like it's an F8.
Could be.
I should probably do Control F8.
That's the theory.
Sometimes Control F8, sometimes Function F8.
Usually Function F8.
Function F8, you're right.
And if that doesn't work, you may have to go into your display control panel.
All right, that's what I tried to do, but I didn't see anything there that gave me an option.
It may be called alignment, it may be called position, or it may just be that this display, when you open displays, there might be a 1 and a 2 monitor. It may think you have a second monitor, and you can move Windows from one monitor to the other monitor. You may just have to remove that second monitor, or I know on the Mac you can drag the monitor positions between what it thinks are your two monitors.
All I have is adjust resolution, adjust brightness, calibrate color, change display settings, connect to a projector, adjust clear type text, and set custom text.
And that's in display properties?
Yeah.
In the control panels.
Oh, correct.
What operating system are you running?
Isn't this ridiculous? Isn't this awful? I can't think of the
XP, Vista 7.
Yes.
Yeah, I don't know Windows 7.
You should be able to go in there. You should be able to go into the connect to a projector thing and tell it don't connect to a projector.
That might be what it thinks there's a projector there.
Okay.
But I'm sorry, without seeing it, he may have a special program running.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not quite sure what to say at this point.
What concerns me even more than just the fact that it's skewed is that the screen is jumping. It's flittering.
Oh, that may be a physical hardware problem with the video card or the video cable.
Yeah,
I'm wondering if it could have been that I need a new driver or something.
Well, the first thing I would do is reboot the laptop.
We tried that and got nowhere.
Okay, then it well may be you need a different driver, or there is something wrong with the driver, with the video card itself in the laptop.
Okay.
A lot of times what we see with laptops is that there's a video cable running from the bottom half of the laptop to the top half of the screen, and it goes through the hinge. And so over time of opening and closing your laptop and moving that hinge, it actually wears out the video cable. And that can cause weird video problems over time.
Okay. I thank you for your assistance.
Yeah, I am sorry.
Sure, yep. Especially if moving the laptop screen makes it flicker or changes how far it skews, then that's a good sign that it is a bad video cable. Unfortunately, it's usually expensive to replace that video cable because you have to tear apart the whole computer and then tear apart the whole display, the monitor itself, to get to both ends of that cable.
Right. But in this particular case, unfortunately, without knowing exactly what she's seeing on the screen and being able to do some detective work on the machine itself to look for programs that might be running or checking the display properties and stuff, it's hard to be able to just legitimately say, click this, and it will be fixed, unfortunately. And if it happens when she reboots, yeah, I got to say it's likely to be either the cable or the video driver or the card. But it's possible that it's a hardware problem.
Something's wrong somewhere.
So yeah, something's wrong somewhere. Brilliant. Brilliant on our part to figure that out. And that's the other interesting difficulty people have with laptops nowadays. They run great until they don't.
Yeah. Well, and we get that question all the time. It worked fine yesterday. What happened? Things work fine until they don't.
Yep.
Something happened, and now it's broken.
Yep, yep, yep. And all of these devices are just electrical devices, and they have lives. They have a lifespan. And, you know, when we
But usually you think something's going to give you advance and notice.
Yeah, you would think that, but it's not like a car.
Well, sometimes it is. If your computer makes weird noises, there's something breaking.
Yeah, right. But there are so few mechanical devices. The hard drive, if you start hearing that whine from your hard drive, back everything up, get a new hard drive.
Or ka-chunk, ka-chunk, ka-chunk.
Right. Or if it doesn't boot, then it boots.
Yeah.
Or if it can't find the drive, then finds the drive. At that moment, back everything up immediately. We should be backing everything up every day anyway. But that means what that ends up being is with electronic stuff, it's like a light bulb. It works until you flip that switch and it blows out. Oh, oops.
If you'd have left it on all the time, it would still be working.
Yeah, what was that light bulb that was on for like 115 years or whatever?
San Francisco Fire Department.
Yeah.
See, but the problem is if you turn it on and off a lot, you wear it out through heating and cooling.
Right.
If you leave it on all the time, you wear it out through running.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I don't know which is
better. So which is quicker?
Yeah. Right. I tend to leave my computer on all the time, but that's a personal preference. You know, my favorite color is green. That doesn't mean yours should be. You know, so that it's that kind of thing all the way around. There is no answer. Everybody says we get that question all the time. My spouse thinks we should turn it off all the time. I think we should leave it on all the time. What do you think? I think it's, you know, if you're going to argue religion or turning on and off your computer, you buy the beer, and we won't argue it here. That's how that works. Religion, politics, and when you leave your computer on all the time.
In the last few years, it's gotten to be more of an environmental issue if your computer's on and running, it's wasting electricity that some power plant is polluting the environment to make for you.
Right.
So at least put it to sleep.
Yes. They do all of that, but it wakes up to do the backups and things like that, so...
When in our old house, when our bedroom was downstairs, when my wife would get up to go to the bathroom in the middle of the night, she had to check her email. And now that the bedroom's upstairs, we don't do that.
Excellent. I can go hours without checking my email.
I know some people can't.
When there's a woot off, I can't go four minutes without checking the computer. But
did you see that 3D Blu-ray player for $48?
I
almost wanted to buy.
I was so
with
close.
Wi-Fi built in, so I don't have to string a cable.
Close to buying it. Yeah.
Ooh, that my my son just strung an Ethernet cable out to the television for his Xbox. I can plug that into my Blu-ray player and run the updates.
Excellent.
I just thought of that. Thank you.
You're welcome.
because my Blu-ray player doesn't do 1080.
Right. Assuming you can wrestle the plug away from your son.
Yeah.
Catch him on a bathroom break.
Yep.
A bio break, as they call it. All right. For no discernible reason, you wasted an entire hour of your life with this show. But fear not. You have another opportunity. We'll be coming back for a whole nother hour of the longest running, some days longer than others, computer show in the known universe. We are Soundbites. When we come back, you'll have the opportunity to give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299, or toll-free 1-800-790-0415. And you can join the great Linda Wildman, who has stepped in to take over from Dave Enright, Steve Ray, who did eventually make it. I'm Nick Francesco. See you on the other side, 59 minutes after the hour. Soundbites on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
On member-supported Jazz 90.1. Get online now. Call 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 800-790-0415. Or submit your question by email at soundbites.org. Once again, here's Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, and Steve Ray on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Steve Ray.
Linda Wildman.
And at 3 minutes after the hour, we are Soundbites. Windows 8 has garnered its share of criticisms in the past few months, and some of that criticism has come from Microsoft's PC partners. Some of them aren't too happy with the way Windows 8 has been supposedly selling, with the latest in the line being Fujitsu. The company this week revised projections for the fiscal year that ends in March, saying that total PC shipments will come in under the 7 million the company had originally planned on. According to Fujitsu president Masami Yamamoto, the company will miss its target because of the weak consumer demand for Microsoft's new operating system. Windows 8 isn't entirely to blame. As Yamamoto also said, demand is on the way down in Europe thanks to the nation's debt crisis. Still, Yamamoto had no problem calling out Windows 8 as the reason why it will miss its projections for the fiscal year. It isn't as if it's simple to make a buck in the PC space these days either. You know that. The market for mobile devices like smartphones and tablets seems to be growing at the expense of demand for laptops and desktops. So if general indifference toward Windows 8 is partially responsible for Fujitsu's lagging sales, that only makes things worse. Yamamoto said that his company won't be dropping PC prices to try to muster some additional sales, which is what some manufacturers have been doing as they see sales coming in under expectations. It doesn't seem like Fujitsu will miss the mark by much, with Yamamoto saying that total shipments for the fiscal year will settle north of 6 million. That's still a million units shy. That's a lot of units. Since the launch of Windows 8, Microsoft has touted 40 million licenses sold, which certainly seems like a healthy number. Of course, we'll keep an eye on the new OS to see how it ultimately performs. So, did you get a Windows 8 computer? What do you think? Give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free, 1-800-790-0415. Just like our friend Linda did from Greece, New York. Welcome, Linda. What's up?
Hi. The answer to your question is no, I didn't get Windows 8. I got Windows 7.
Well, that's a good thing.
My question to you, I got two questions. One, I called the last week and spoke to Dave about trying to get into the forum. I put in my passion must be 50 times. It says it's inactive. Okay? Well, that's that part, and I don't know if you can solve it. Second, Nick, what about Gmail? I heard they're going to change something in Gmail. Is that going to affect my Gmail account?
I don't know what
Google,
you heard.
Google Sync. They're discontinuing Google's enterprise syncing software. So
right.
if you were using an Exchange client in businesses, that's being discontinued unless you pay for your Google Mail account. So for the vast majority of average people who are just using regular Google Mail, it won't change anything on your phone or your computer.
Oh, okay. But what about the Soundbite forum? It says it's inactive. And when I called last week, Dave said I could just get in. I must have tried 50 times.
Linda, you need to actually talk to Dave directly.
Oh, okay.
You need to be at your computer talking to Dave during the day when he's there, because I can't get into it right now, and I wouldn't give you a password over the phone, over the radio anyway.
I've got my password.
Right. Well, but something's not right, and you need to talk to Dave. You've either got to
give him a call at his office.
The old, maybe he had a different, username for you. Maybe he updated the wrong person. You and he need to talk directly at a time when it's not public over the air.
Okay. No, I set up a new account. That's what I did. Set up a brand new account.
Then he has to activate that new account. He may have been reactivating your old account.
Right. So that's why you need to talk to him directly.
So the Gmail thing, I have no problem getting.
No, you're not going to notice that at all. If you weren't trying to sync your mail to a corporate enterprise system, you're not going to have a problem at all.
Okay. Happy New Year, guys and lady.
You too. Have fun.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.
What I'm interested in and a little worried about is on the iPhone and iOS devices, Google's procedure for setting up Google services has been to tell it you're using an Exchange server.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Which I'm worried, you know, as soon as they shut the, what is it, January 30th, they're shutting down Google Sync.
When I looked at the iPad.
You can set it up as standard IMAP for mail and CardDAV and CalDAV.
One of the
Gmail.
Gmail.
Gmail, yes. When you're setting up your calendar,
right.
They tell you to use Exchange.
Right.
And with the internet protocols of CalDAV for calendars and CardDAV for contacts becoming so widely adopted, that's why Google is shutting down Google Sync for Exchange Active Sync. So people who have had their iOS devices for a very long time, if you told it you're using Exchange for your calendars, you may have to reconfigure it to use CardDAV, basically as a Gmail account rather than an Exchange account.
Right.
And you'll be able to tell that, if I could reach my iPad, if you go into Settings and then go into Mail Contacts Calendars.
Well, you go ahead and get it.
If one of them says Exchange on it, then you may have to change your settings.
Right. The way it works on the Android device is you can have both active simultaneously.
Yeah.
And it will show you stuff out of both.
Right.
So it would seem that that's, you know, they don't sync, but you can see them both, which I think is equally usable. So you're going into Settings.
Settings, and then under Mail Contacts and Calendars. Let's see, that's not my iCloud. Where's my Google account? I've got Google. Yeah, see, I have it set up as an Exchange account for my calendars because that's how Google was telling everyone to do it in the early days of iOS. So I'll see what happens after January 30th if this stops working.
Yeah, right.
If you pay for your Google account, so if you're using the business version, then ActiveSync will still work.
But did you install ActiveSync?
No. Using Google Sync, you go to the Google Sync website and say, I want to synchronize these calendars to these devices. And that is what I think is being shut down as well as the ActiveSync options.
Yep. All right. I guess we'll see what that's about. In the meantime, we're going to go back to the phones and talk to Carl way down there in Pottsville, PA. How are you, Carl? How's the weather down there?
Oh, pretty good so far. I haven't been outside yet, so I'm not quite sure.
There you go.
I was wondering, I'm using Internet Explorer 8, and I have a bunch of favorites saved in the favorites, whatever you call it, file,
right.
I guess. And I have Carbonite, and I want to make sure that Carbonite backs up the favorites. Is there a way to do that?
Carbonite backs up everything unless you tell it not to, as far as I'm aware. And favorites are just a folder. It's an invisible folder in an invisible folder. In your user folder.
Okay, so basically, I don't have to do anything then.
Yeah,
no,
we're checking to see if Carbonite specifically includes. I would guess they would specifically include your favorites.
Well, I'm not sure they're turned on by default, but they probably are. You theoretically, you should be able to go into what the list of what Carbonite backs up, and it should be listed there.
Yeah. And I think by default, it backs up everything.
Yeah. Internet Explorer 8 has not changed the place where it saves everything. So if it just says Internet Explorer, you're still good.
Yeah, here it backs up your Chrome bookmarks automatically, backs up your Firefox bookmarks automatically, backs up your Internet Explorer favorites automatically.
Yeah. Okay, great. I'm glad to hear that.
There you go.
Okay, thanks a lot, guys.
Yep, good luck.
See, that's one of those hidden files that, if you run your own backup program, you may not see. Your mail, your contacts, your favorites are all in a hidden file inside your user folder, both on Mac and Windows. And so typically what you would do is tell it to back up your entire user folder, not just your documents folder. That way it gets all that other stuff as well.
Right. All right, our next caller is Harry from Brighton, New York. Welcome, Harry. What's your question? Henry. Oh, you're right. It says Henry. Unlike with Dave, I'm the one who screwed up this time. It actually says Henry.
Okay.
I just read Harry because I think you should have been named that, Henry.
You need a new pair of glasses.
I need new something. I know that.
I'm having a problem with, I don't know whether it's Firefox or FrontierNet. I subscribe, I have a DSL service through Frontier, and I look at my email, my Frontier email, through Firefox. And for the most part, it's been working just fine. But recently, what happens is, if I'm working with various emails, I reach a point where a dialog box comes up, which says, re-enter your password, your username and password. And when I do that, either nothing happens, or it just blinks at me and says, re-enter your username and password again. I tried using Internet Explorer, which I normally don't use, that works. I don't have that problem with that. So I think it's something to do, some interaction between Firefox and the FrontierNet application or...
Yeah, the Frontier website.
It
sounds like it might be a timeout.
Yep.
That if you're logged into a website, and this happens on a lot of places you log into, after a certain amount of time, it asks you to log in again to make sure you're still there.
Yeah, I understand that. But this happens sometimes after a relatively short time. And then sometimes when I do log in again, you know, sometimes the dialogue comes up and I log in again. And
doesn't let you in.
It works for a while, like for maybe 5 or 10 minutes, and then the box comes up again, and then sometimes it'll work and sometimes it doesn't work where I can log in again. I have tried, sometimes just logging off will help, or sometimes I just have to reboot and get some success in that respect.
What version of Firefox are you using?
I believe it is the latest version.
It may be too new and something changed.
It's 17.0.1.
That should not matter. And you're logged in as the user.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I doubt there's a way to change the timeout setting.
Yeah, I was wondering if there was something in Firefox that might be affecting this, but
well, it's got to be if it works fine in
Explorer. Explorer, yeah.
But I can't think of what it would be, and I'm not seeing any sort of... Did this recently start, or has it been...
Yes, yeah. It started, maybe 2 weeks ago.
Do you perhaps... Is it... Are you... Oh! Are you going in as HTTP or HTTPS?
Oh, I just said it is HTTPS.
It is HTTPS.
Yes.
That was the wrong answer.
That's the wrong answer.
Let me ask it again. Are you going in as... Never mind.
Yeah.
Because you definitely want to be going in as secure, and it may have been logging you out differently because you were on.
I'll have to keep an eye on that. Maybe somehow it switched to HTTP. I never noticed.
Where's the little padlock icon in Firefox?
Padlock icon.
Well, when you're on a secure website, the browsers typically put a little padlock icon to tell you you're logged in securely.
Did you go in as HTTPS?
I just typed webmail. So
you probably didn't.
It's probably not. Interesting.
Right next to the back arrow, there is a little vague icon that says, website does not supply identity information.
All right. So, yeah, you should have a little padlock icon to the left. No, it disappeared now. But it shows me the URL now. So a lot of browsers are now hiding that HTTP:// because it isn't absolutely necessary.
Yeah.
So when I typed https://, I saw the little padlock that told me it was encrypted, but then the little padlock went away, but it shows me the S, which is weird. And I'm on 1701. Make sure you're running secure. Well, for two reasons. One is you don't want anyone to see your mail.
Sure.
And see your mail password. That may help it from timing out as much.
Mm-hmm.
But if it's a timeout issue, it's usually the other end saying they're timing you out because you may not have done anything in a while. But if it's happening while you're doing stuff, usually timeout is like 10 or 15 minutes.
Yeah. As I say, this doesn't happen on Internet Explorer. And in fact, when I called up Frontier, they said they support Internet Explorer. They do not, they won't help you with Firefox issues.
Yeah, a lot of people are doing that.
Yeah. And one thing I'm thinking we're just seeing doing is just migrating over to Google Mail and maybe just...
Well, the other thing you could do is run a mail program on your computer, like Thunderbird.
Thunderbird or something like that, yeah.
Well, I'll tell you what. Here's the big thing for me. I try never to use my internet service provider's mail system, because if I change my internet service provider,
sure,
I lose my mail.
Yes, yes.
So my suggestion would be, while I have Frontier, I use Frontier, I don't use their email. My suggestion is go get a Google account.
Yeah, I have one.
That'll live forever.
And you can have Google.
And start migrating everybody over.
Start migrating, yeah.
Right, and until you tell everyone your new email address, you can have Google pick up your Frontier mail, too.
Yes, yeah. I know you can do that. Yeah, I've been thinking of doing that for a long time, and I think it's about time.
I would suggest that only be, and I'm not saying anything against Frontier's email. Like I said, I'm a Frontier customer.
Well, I think they started having problems when they started getting Yahoo to be the underlying engine behind their email.
We're seeing a lot of problems with Yahoo.
Yeah,
the SMTP is problematic. But
yeah,
the reality is that, in general, not using your ISP's email address means that you have one single email address for your whole life, no matter where you move, no matter whether you change your provider, it doesn't matter.
Right.
Yeah, a lot of people are resistant to change providers because that means you have to change your email address.
Yes.
But like you said, you can set up Google Mail to pick up your email from your other provider.
Right.
So you can immediately change over, and as long as that account is active, you're good to go. And in the meantime, you can send email to all your friends saying, you need to change over, you need to change over.
Yep.
All righty.
Okay, so you'll probably get one of those something.
All right,
yourself.
It's a deal. I'll be looking forward to it. Thanks.
Okay.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes with Linda Weilman, Steve Ray, me, Nick Francesco, and you. It is 20 minutes after the hour, and you continue to listen to the longest-running computer show in the known universe. We're Soundbites, right here on the truly great, member-supported Jazz 90.1. Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Steve Ray.
Linda Weilman.
And at 23 minutes after the hour, we are Soundbite.
I just went to Google's website on how to set up Google Calendar with your iOS device, and they're still telling you to use Exchange. And at the top, it says this won't work anymore for only Google apps for business, education, and government. So what are they going to do for the other people that want to use Google Calendar on their iPad? They don't have instructions up yet.
Well, they've got until the end of the month and the end of next month.
End of next month, yeah.
So you've got plenty of time. That's next year.
Yeah, next year. So is that one of your stories? 17 million smart device activations?
Yeah.
On Christmas Day alone. So those 17 million people hooked up their Google accounts with Exchange.
Not all of them. Some of them
bought
Android devices.
Yeah.
Shocking as that may be to you. The year 2012 was another one in which Apple defied market skeptics and delivered an unlikely hit, the iPad Mini, in the face of stiff competition. But it wouldn't be a normal Apple year without at least one last rumor to send us scratching our heads into the new year, anxiously wondering what the company has up its sleeve yet. The latest rumor isn't necessarily earth-shaking, but it is nevertheless surprising. Sources based in China, and this is a rumor. Sources based in China claim that Apple is working on releasing a smartwatch. According to a report on China's TGBus.com, the Bluetooth-enabled smartwatch will feature a 1.5-inch touchscreen display and work directly with the iPhone, allowing users to make phone calls and perform other operations from their wrists. First spotted by tech site The Next Web, the watch is supposedly a joint project between Apple and Intel. This new talk of a smart watch might seem outlandish on its face. Get it? That is, until you begin to examine some of Apple's recent moves. Earlier this year, Apple decided to update the iPod Nano with a totally new design, one that instantly rendered obsolete iPod Nano accessories that essentially turned the device into a kind of a smartwatch. Kickstarter projects like the TikTok and Lunatic iPod Nano watch straps had raised just shy of $1 million, proving that a healthy market exists for iPad Nano owners who want to turn the music device into some kind of smartwatch. So, months later, when Apple inexplicably changed the design of the iPad Nano to a form factor that many agree is something of a step backward, market speculation immediately focused on the notion that Apple might be attempting to displace the would-be smartwatch competitors and thus clear the table for its own forthcoming smartwatch. And then there's the, I've said smartwatch way too many times already and I'm not done yet. And then there's the much-anticipated Pebble smartwatch. The upstart smartwatch company is famously listed as the most successful Kickstarter project ever, raising over $10 million during its brief fundraising period. One other piece of related Apple news to consider is the company's recent deal with the Swiss Federal Railway. After the launch of iOS 6, the Swiss organization claimed that Apple had included its watch face design in the updated iPad operating system and violated the organization's copyright. The two parties soon came to an agreement that allowed Apple to license the iconic watch face design. Although terms of the agreement were not confirmed by either company, one Swiss news source claimed that Apple paid about $21 million for the license. The notion that Apple would pay such a high price for the use of a simple watch face design inside iOS 6 that could just as easily have been changed raised quite a few eyebrows. But that move also serves as yet another hint that Apple may have bigger plans for that watch face design beyond using it as a mere component of iOS 6. Also, Microsoft had a smartwatch for a while that died a miserable and completely undeserved, I thought, death. So would you buy an iPad watch? Why or why not? Give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299, toll-free 1-800-790-0415. I don't even wear a watch anymore.
Yeah, that's the usual answer is I don't wear a watch because I have my phone. But we're starting to see, especially when in the Apple world, when the Nano had those watch faces, more and more people were starting to wear their iPod as a watch because it had your music and stuff on it. The latest Nano that they made long and rectangular again, so screwing the watch potential out of it, does add Bluetooth. So that was the missing link. That what people would like to see is your phone vibrates, you know, the message or an email or something. I don't want to have to take it, I'm too lazy, to take it out of my pocket and look at the screen and put it back in my pocket. So if I can just bring my wrist up and see on, oh, it's a message from home, I better answer that one. So they have that link between your wrist and your and
right, so to use it as a call ID,
yeah. And that kind of goes along with the Google Glasses, that if we start wearing these Google Glasses where it projects on your glass, your glasses, that you know, message from home or you know, message from the boss, those are the ones you want to answer,
right?
And then you start getting spam on your glasses.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am.
No, she's waving at the other camera.
Oh, all right. Who is?
We had some people enter the building, and I thought maybe I could wave, but never mind.
There's no camera there for them to see you, though.
Well, they can look at the window.
Yeah.
They can look in the window.
That's very true. They can. Then they would see the back of you waving. Okay, I get it. All right. Whatever. I'm good with it. But, yeah, and you can already apparently do that with Google Glasses. I've seen many of the demos, and they include getting a phone call.
Yep.
Through your Android phone and then being able to see the caller on your glasses and then say, you yep. know, answer or whatever. They're
trying to replace Smithers. This is Jim. His wife is Nancy, and they have three kids. And
yeah, right.
Whispering in your ear when you go up to meet someone.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And for guys like me who have no, I can't remember people's names. It's called anomia, an inability to remember nouns, in particular proper nouns.
And you just forgot what you were going to say next.
I forgot what I was going to say next.
For women, that's menopause.
Yeah, right. Well, they say it's either an early form of Alzheimer's or it's ADHD. It's a form of ADHD. I've had it my entire life, so I'm betting more on the ADHD than I am on the Alzheimer's.
Anomic aphasia.
There you go.
Yep.
And so that's, yeah, I can't remember people's names. You can tell me your name, and I will forget it instantly. I'll remember it an hour later,
yep.
But I can't call you that.
But I'm good with faces. Faces
and
voices.
With faces and
oh,
voices.
I know that voice. Yep. Yeah.
The problem I have is that the more pressure.
Yeah.
Like if you were to show me a picture of somebody I haven't seen here, I go, oh, that's Fred or Nancy or whatever it
yep.
is. But if they're right in front of me and I now have to introduce them to you, they're gone. They're gone out of my head.
I read, heard John C. Dvorak had a great trick for that when you come up with someone. Hey, how you doing? What are you up to now? Give me your new business card with your name
yeah,
and address
yeah, right,
on
right,
it
right, right, right,
and where you work. And so I can remember all that now.
I once was walking through Midtown Plaza, which tells you how long I've had this problem, with my oldest friend in the world. I mean, I have literally known him since I was 3 years old. We were walking through the mall, and we met a lady that I knew that he didn't. So I introduced him. Oh, Betty, this is hi, Betty. Good to see you. This is my friend who lives two doors down from me. I've known him for 20 years. And he knows all about this. So he just was not going to help because, you know, he's my friend. So he was not going to help.
Just the kind of friend he is.
Exactly. And it's terrible. I can, if there's no pressure, I've got your name in my head, no problem. If there's pressure, I have a problem with it. There were twice already today. Linda Wildman's gone out of my head. Just gone out of my head. And it's not like I don't know who you are. It was just gone out of my head. All right, back to the phones. And what's his name from wherever is called? Tom from Rochester, New York. See, I got it written in front of me, so it's not bad. Welcome, Tom. What's your question?
I forgot.
Yeah.
No. I have. I use Windows Live Mail, and with Windows 7. And recently, I got an iPad. And when I check my mail on iPad, and well, like when I'm away, and I delete it, get it out of the trash, and it always stays on my PC. And on the Windows Live Mail, I went to the accounts and said, you know, we had. Don't leave the message on the server.
On the server, yeah.
So I just how can I when I delete when I'm away and I delete a message off of my email on the iPad? How can I get it to not show up next time I get on my PC?
On the iPad, you have to set it up as an IMAP account. IMAP. And this is sort of a trick for any email service except Roadrunner, which doesn't support IMAP. With IMAP, your device is always looking at the server. So if you delete something on the device, it deletes it from the server immediately. And then your other computer, which is using IMAP, is doing the same thing.
So you only see the remaining mails.
So you go into your mail settings. What I'm guessing is it set it up as POP, because with POP it downloads to your device and then doesn't care what happens to any other device or to the server. So you likely need to delete that POP account from your iPad and then reset it up as an IMAP account.
Okay. All righty. Okay. Can I ask one other quick question?
Sure.
I've been getting inundated with emails for stuff I don't want. And I, on my PC, I always go and I block the sender, block the domain, but it hasn't stopped the emails
yeah.
from coming.
And that never helps anyway, because typically the sender doesn't exist anymore and the domains don't exist anymore, because the bad guys create random senders and random domains, send out a bunch of mail, and then stop using that domain again because they know people are blocking those domains.
See, one of the problems is that in many places, you can register a domain and you have to pay for it for 30 days.
Mm-hmm.
So they register a domain, send out blasts of email for 29 days, and then just give it up.
Or until they get shut down by complaints.
Down and,
yeah.
And then they just give it up and move on to the next one. So they're always coming from someplace different. They're always doing something different. That's why a lot of places nowadays don't use the username or or site that it's coming from as the way they block it. They do something with heuristics. The computer figures out what's bad. It looks inside the email for, you know, the words Viagra or whatever, and that's how it blocks them.
And mail services like Gmail do a really, really good job at that. I don't know offhand how well Windows Live Mail does.
Okay.
But typically in your mail reader program, there's a mark this as junk mail. And so your mail reader learns a little bit about that also and can learn what you think junk is. Because that's the other problem is how do you define junk mail? What if I want to get a low mortgage or increased parts of my body?
Right.
So it's very hard to determine.
Earlobes. You meant earlobes.
Earlobes, yep. What exactly is junk mail? So your mail reader will have a thumbs up or thumbs down or mark as junk or not junk as well.
But again, in your particular case, because you have multiple mail readers, you would have to set each of them to do that. Because what you set on the iPad will not be set on your computer.
Okay, now how do I do that then?
Well, it depends on what email program you're running. If you're running it on the web, then there should be some... I don't use Windows Live Email, so I'm afraid I can't give you explicit directions. But for everything, there's usually some sort of actions drop down, and one of the choices is mark as spam or mark as junk.
Well, they do. They automatically go into the junk mail folder. But then I have to go in and just delete them all the time.
Well, you can set the mail program to auto-delete the junk folder.
After a certain number of days.
It's usually a good idea to look in your junk folder now and then to see if a mail accidentally got marked as junk.
Yeah,
but
right.
You can usually set your mail reader program to automatically delete junk. And I think most of this mail services delete their junk folder after a month or so anyway.
Okay. All righty. Okay, well, thanks for your help.
Thanks.
Okay.
Yeah, there's spam is just never going to go away. I don't care what anybody says. It's just not going to happen. The big problem becomes something like Tom's where he's got multiple devices reading the same email. You still have to set each device
right
to understand that this is spam.
One of the things that some mail companies have tried doing is setting up a whitelist so you can only receive mail from people on your whitelist. Well, that becomes annoying because then you can't get new mail from anyone. What happens, my mother uses this service too, you get an email back saying, we won't accept your email until you fill out this form and get on the whitelist.
Right.
And half the time I don't feel like filling out the form, and it wasn't that important anyway.
Yeah, right.
But so whitelists can work, but they're a lot more hassle for legitimate users than they stop the junk from coming through.
Right. And again, that happens to a lot of people also when they switch email providers.
Yeah.
So if you stick with one, you get a Gmail account or whatever account you're going to get. And then you never change it, then that helps with that at least a little bit. One of the interesting things that happened to me this week was I've started to use my Google Voice number instead of my cell phone number for people. And several people have my cell phone number, don't have my Google Voice number.
Yeah.
So they didn't answer me.
Yeah.
So they don't know who I am.
Yeah, call ID means I don't have to answer a call I don't recognize.
Right. So that's an interesting thing. All right, our next caller is Don from Henrietta, New York. Welcome, Don. What's your question?
Well, it's John Larish. I don't know Nick.
John, how are you?
Yeah.
How boy do I remember you?
Sound familiar?
Yes. How are you?
Well, doing well with a couple of new knees, but still writing. I've done 16 books since I saw you last, including the last one, which is Out of Focus, which tells the story about how Kodak got into the deep stuff.
Oh, that nice. Yeah, that must have been an awfully large book.
No, it wasn't a large book because you can pin the tail on just a few donkeys.
Yeah, I was just thinking that. As I said it, I realized it's probably three names and a whole bunch of blank pages.
Yeah, that's exactly what we've got. The last one. The story on the last one, I think Antonio went down to Washington in February a couple of years ago, snowed overnight, and the hangar that they had the plane parked in, the roof fell in, totally destroying the Kodak plane.
Oops.
Insurance company paid for it all. I think God was talking to Antonio, but he wasn't listening yet.
Well, you sound good, anyway. John.
Yes.
You sound good.
Oh, thank you. I still love doing some radio, still do occasionally television. I did when I was having some rehab at the Jewish home, using an iPad, I did an actual dinner address in Washington, D.C. So I still keep my finger in on the pulse all the time.
Nice.
Yeah, for new listeners, John was one of our frequent contributors 20-odd years ago in previous radio stations. Dealing with digital photography and Kodak, and I love the cover of your new book, Out of Focus. It's out of focus.
Well, Kodak certainly is yet, and it's a shame to say it, but I don't think they can survive because they put all of their eggs now into this printing area.
Yeah,
and all of a sudden, coming out of Israel is new printing technology, which is nanotechnology. Mm-hmm.
And so many people don't print anymore anyway. It just goes up to Facebook.
Absolutely. And the same with look at the mail situation, because the post office is in deep trouble now because people aren't mailing as much as they did.
Right. And instead of jumping on the bandwagon in some way, they either fought it or ignored it. And now it's too late.
This new printing technology that's coming out of Israel looks very, very promising, and this could really upset Kodak's apple cart badly because it's much sharper, it's much faster drying, and they've revolutionized it. They're the same ones that created the press that HP is using now.
Oh, yeah.
So it's kind of interesting. You know, they're still following those things and still talking to people, still doing consulting. Not traveling quite as much as I used to, though. That I've slowed down on.
No, I bet you have. Listen, can you hang on the phone? We got to take a quick break. Stay on the phone. We'll talk to you when we come back. Back in just a couple of minutes with Linda Wildman, Steve Ray, John Larish. I'm delighted to say that. Me, Nick Francesco, and you. 42 minutes after the hour, Sound Bites on member-supported Jazz 90.1. Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Steve Ray.
I'm Linda Wildman.
And at 44 minutes after the hour, we are joined on the phone by friend of the show, John Larish. So, John, are you there? John?
Well, it's been very interesting watching the changes and looking at the efforts that, for example, the Consumer Electronics Association is trying to bring more innovation into the whole field. And, of course, that's just exactly where Kodak fell flat on its face, you know, when it didn't really utilize the inventions that they had sitting on their back shelves.
Exactly. They invented so much technology, and the same thing happened with a couple of other companies. Xerox did it.
Yeah, and Xerox is still okay at the moment, but they could be in trouble, too, because I think they've missed some of the opportunities that they could have had.
Yep. Now, I know it's a little outside your field, but have you had any experience with the 3D printing?
In the printing side of it, the creation of devices, yes, I've seen that, and I see that as a marketing opportunity for a lot of people to create three-dimensional objects. It's phenomenal. I've seen some of that at work, and the prices have come down tremendously on it, if that's the one you're talking about.
Yeah. Everything from the little MakerBot type to the giant sintered metal things. I fully admit I want one, and I'm just waiting for prices to reach a range that I can afford.
What I always joke about is at night after you go home, you should tell the MakerBot to make more MakerBots.
They do that. You can actually using, I don't remember if it's a MakerBot or one of the other things, but they actually, aside from a couple of the metal pieces that brace it, you can actually make one with one.
Yep, you can, and it's just amazing. I've been talking to clients that I'm suggesting to them to think of that as a possible tool that they can use for additional markets with digital imaging.
Yeah.
Why not?
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, they were talking about the ability to you put one on the space station, and instead of having to bring three or four wrenches with you, if you lose one, print another one.
That's right. And there's so much more coming, too, that in the way of lasers and they've come up with new things now. There are two publications that I get every month. One is from the Optical Society of America, and the other was from the Photonics Group.
Yeah.
When I read those, it blows my mind every month because of the advancements that we're seeing made in those areas. And, of course, those were areas that were close to Kodak's heart, you know. And
yep.
they invented the OLED, and people are now thinking of what else could I do with OLEDs, and we're seeing the big screens coming in that we'll be seeing in Las Vegas in January. So it's going to be interesting.
Yep. How do you feel, though? I mean, you're the company that invented a whole bunch of things, and you're watching other companies take what you invented, leapfrog you, and just keep running.
And then in your bankruptcy proceedings, you had to sell off all your patents to Apple and Google.
Yeah, and on top of that, they got 500 mil, and they thought it was going to be 22 several bill.
Yeah,
billions. Yeah.
That's the part that was amazing. I don't know who the company was that did the estimating on the patents, but I sure would not send them a check for their services.
Yeah.
Well, no kidding. And in addition to that, the other end of it is, you know, what's interesting to me is that Apple and Google and HP and a couple of other companies didn't compete for those patents. They joined together to buy the patents, which is another reason they went so cheap.
Well, that's sort of what happened at the Nortel patent auction a few months ago, is that Google, was it Google and Microsoft and Apple? They were all, you know, sort of competing. And then I think it was Apple and Microsoft joined together and outbid Google individually.
Yep. Yep.
So these consortiums get together. Then they don't end up suing each other later on.
Right.
And so this time Google joined the consortium to get in on that patent. Because Kodak was suing Apple for $1 billion for some of the patents. And one of Apple's first digital cameras back in the 90s was designed and built by Apple. The original QuickTake was an Apple Kodak partnership.
By Kodak.
Yeah.
It was actually a Kodak camera, a Kodak design.
Yep.
And it was very interesting because at that point they were having people in Japan start to design. And the suggestion, the direction that they were given by Rochester was, you only to make black cameras.
Yeah.
I'm tired of all electronics being black. I'm really tired of it.
I know it. Well, there's another one, too, that Kodak had on the back shelf about a year or so ago, and I'd love to find out what happened. They had a laser projector for theaters.
Oh.
It looked very, very promising. They were ready to show it and debut it, and all of a sudden it disappeared off the face of the earth. And they're still trying to peddle some movie film.
Yeah.
But I think that everybody that, if anybody's gone to see a digital film, digital is pretty damn impressive in the theaters.
Yep.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing stuff.
It sure is.
What
we've seen so much. Between the time that you sold me my first computer, Nick Francisco, back in 1980 or 81.
81, I think it was.
Yeah, and I carried it around on airplanes because it was the size almost of a two-seater luggage piece.
Yeah, the old Osborne 1.
That's it. We go back in history, and yet we've seen such advancement. And unfortunately, that advancement was happening around us here in Rochester, and we didn't realize it.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. Listen, John, I'd love to talk more, but I got more people on the line.
Good. Okay, and thanks so much for taking it.
Oh, we don't get more people on the line.
Hope we stay in touch.
All right, you too, John. Call again, please.
I shall do. Thanks.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Oh, I lied. There isn't anybody else on the line? Oh, that's my fault. Oh, you lost them. Oh, I see. That's
there was someone on the line.
So probably heard us chit-chatting away and thought, oh, I'm not getting on. So they hung up.
Yeah.
John Larish was one of our original contributors on this show. There isn't anybody who has the depth and breadth of knowledge about printing and photography and all the other stuff that he's got in his head. He's an amazing man. It's always a delight to talk to him. He writes books like it's easy.
Yeah.
I hate him for that. John, I hope you're still listening. I want you to know that part about you I hate. He writes them like he was just typing them, not actually having to write them.
Yeah.
You know, 16 books since the last time we talked to him. An amazing human being, and we're delighted that he still calls us his friend. Next caller is Joe from Chicago, New York. Welcome, Joe. What's your question?
Howdy. Recently, I picked myself up a wireless router and went into its settings, and it said, okay, disable the WPA pin, which I think is going to pretty much disable the WPA security problem. But
right.
I was wondering if it is still possible to semi-securely still use the WPA push button on the router.
Well, what you really want to use is WPA2.
Well, there's the auto setup, WPS, wireless protection setup.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Setup.
Yeah, WPS yeah. setup. I'm sorry.
A lot of routers have this automatic setup where you push a button on the router and then you type a pin into the computer. There was a huge security flaw discovered in that setup in that most companies use a four-digit pin that's printed on the router, and quite often it's the same four-digit pin on every router. And some companies use an eight-digit pin, but they keep reusing the same pin. In fact, Security Now did a big podcast on this. Bottom line was to turn off the wireless protected setup, the WPS, on your router so that bad guys couldn't sneak into your network. But the problem is that makes it a little harder for you to set up the products you do want connected to your network. So by disabling the pin, theoretically, you're turning off the problem.
So my suggestion would be, if you really want to use WPS, put in a pin when you want to add a new device to the network. Once you've added it, remove the pin.
Yes, yeah, so turn down for a minute, do what you need to, turn off for a minute. So you're only vulnerable for those couple of minutes.
Because it's only for setup.
Right, right. It's just, yeah, I have like an 18-character passphrase, and it's just tedious, and I'm just wondering if it would be safe to use the button instead.
Yeah, especially on a mobile device where it's tricky to type in some of those special characters you may want to use in your password.
Right. But again, if you put it...
Nexus 7, it's not too bad.
What?
The Nexus 7, it's not too bad. The keyboard is just about large enough, you know.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, I would suggest that you turn it on when you need it. Once the device you want to add is set up, turn it off again until you need it again.
Not bad.
Basic idea being that you don't have to worry then about non-authorized people guessing the PIN number. And again, if it's a 16-character PIN, well, that's it's pretty unlikely.
One of the problems is that some of the routers, and I'm trying to find the list of them there were, if you turned off WPS in the settings, it didn't really turn it off.
Great,
yeah.
Well, and that's why you disable the PIN number. So you put the PIN number in when you want to set somebody up, take the PIN number out again when you don't.
And some of the routers, the PIN number is hard-coded on the router. Yeah.
Well, at any rate, I'd have to suggest you give that a try.
Dig around in the Security Now archives on WPS, and he has some recommendations there and what routers to not use.
All right. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks. Well, that music tells me we're done for another week. For no discernible reason, you've been willing to waste 2 hours of your life, except for the few minutes we talked to John Lirish, which is never a waste of time. You've wasted 2 hours of your life chatting with us. We want to thank each and every one of you who've called in. Those of you who did not get online, I apologize. You need to call in earlier. Stay tuned because George is in, and he will be playing the best German music you will hear all week. In the meantime, we're going to take some time off, and we'll be back next Saturday. I'm just going to spend the week with my feet up snoring. You think not? Thank you all. It's 55 minutes after the hour. We're Soundbites on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Here are the Jazz